Welcome back to The Word at Work. This is the podcast for Christian professionals, where we dig into topics to support you in thriving professionally and, of greatest importance, living biblically. Well, after a few short summer episodes, followed by our planned month-long break in August, we are back with guest episodes. I'm so excited about the conversations we have planned for this fall, and I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to have them and share them with you. Well, if you've been hanging out with us on this podcast for a while, thank you for your support and for sharing the show with friends. And if you are one of our new listeners, it's so good to have you, and I hope you'll join the mailing list at mirandacarls.com to stay up to date on all the content we put out for Christian professionals. And as always, if you have a few seconds to leave a positive review or click the 5 stars on the platform you are listening in, that is greatly appreciated. I'm really excited about today's conversation. I have a lot of respect for the work of the Colson Center and their work equipping Christians to live out their faith right here and right now with confidence and clarity. So today we are joined by Shane Morris, senior writer at the Colson Center. If you utilize their resources, he's a familiar voice on a lot of their videos and podcasts and through articles. So let's chat Christian worldview, culture, and more with today's guest, Shane Morris. Shane, it's so good to have you joining us today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here, Miranda.
So you and your wife were chatting a little bit before hitting record. You live in Florida with your kiddos. Where did you initially grow up? Are you a born and raised Floridian?
We're both born and raised Floridian. She was born in Jacksonville. I was born in a place called Brandon, right outside of Tampa. And we grew up here, going to the beach, camping on islands, doing all that kind of fun Florida stuff. And we got married and spent 4 years in the Washington, D.C. area, going to a church up there and working with Breakpoint, which was then a part of Prison Fellowship. So I kind of got mixed up in the whole like D.C. Christian scene, which is a lot of fun for a lot of reasons, but chiefly because it's not exactly a Christian friendly place at the top levels. And so Christians are very self-conscious about that fact. And they think about it all the time and sort of navigate the challenges. But we moved back to Florida after the Colson Center went to Colorado Springs, because I can't stand to be far from the ocean. I have to be close to the ocean. And because our families live here.
Okay, good. Yes, I've always longed to be near the ocean, but actually have never lived outside the state of Missouri. I grew up in North Central Missouri, very rural, like farmland. And I was reflecting on this as I was thinking about our conversation today, because I really think that growing up, I had this perception that most people were Christians. Not that everyone lived biblically, but that most people, if they were filling out a questionnaire that under religion, that they would select a Christian. And we all know that that's not what it feels like anymore. And I don't think that was purely a rural North Missouri farmland kind of thing either. I think that's just the cultural shift that we're seeing. Few observations I know I've seen and that people will comment on. We tend to see, of course, anti-Christian messages being very loudly celebrated. There seem to be fewer people comfortable even like wearing that label of Christian, and even an increase of maybe we'll call it negative sentiments towards Christians and Christianity, differing definitions of evil and good, all of that. And I know, of course, you spend a lot of time thinking about this and writing about this. So what have you observed, Shane, and how would you describe, as you call it, our current cultural moment?
There are three kind of categories that come to mind when I think about where our culture is at right now. The first is that we're very distracted. Mm-hmm. I just interviewed Samuel James, who wrote a book. This was on the Upstream podcast, Colson Center's Upstream podcast. I interviewed him about his book, Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. And he really documents, a feeling that pretty much all of us have below the surface, but we rarely articulate or talk about. And that is that something's changed in the past decade and a half, that the way our brains work has actually changed. And we can't read books the way we used to. We can't concentrate on tasks the way we used to. We're in church even, and we're trying to worship God. And we have this urge to pull out our phones and look at them and check social media or whatever, see what the chatter is all about. And Obviously, this is perverse, and we recognize it as perverse, but he zeroes in on what caused it. So I think we're extraordinarily distracted, and that goes for Christians and non-Christians alike. We're all sort of, unless we've made conscious choices to divest of this whole tech-centric environment, which is difficult for a lot of reasons, we are tremendously distracted. It's hard for us to concentrate on sustained thought for a long time. And I think Christianity is a creature of sustained thought. It lives in the realm of dialogue and discourse and getting it all out there in intellectual debate. As Screwtape talks about in C.S. Lewis's the Screwtape Letters, don't move your patient onto the ground of debate and logic and thinking and reason, because the enemy is better at that than we are. God is better at that than the devil is. So we're very distracted. Second thing is we're super isolated. And this is, there's a bunch of books that have been written about this. Yeah. But one of the chief ones in the last 10 years is Mary Eberstadt's How the West Really Lost God. And this is one that hit me between the eyes a couple months ago when I first read it, because her theory is essentially that the decline of Christianity and religion in general in the West is accompanied by, and probably in many cases caused by, the decline of the family, because she sees the family as the primary means of transmitting not just the belief in Jesus and God, but also the plausibility structure in which Jesus makes sense, in which the religion of Christianity makes sense. And when we don't have that, when we're isolated from all our institutions and all our families and everything that gives life meaning other than our own individuality, right, then religion itself, faith itself, becomes much less plausible. So that's another thing. And then the last thing is we're individualistic, but in very unoriginal ways. And what I mean about that, what I mean by that is, we've writers like Carl Truman have covered how the modern self is a self-made person. It's someone who looks inward and then says, what do I find there? Now my mission in life, the meaning of the world, is to externalize my inner selfhood onto the world around me, be authentic, be myself, and then demand that everyone conform to that. But you'll notice that's not actually very individualistic. It's kind of the script that everyone's following. So it's individualistic, but it's cliche. It's unoriginal. It's just what everybody's doing. So those three things, distracted, isolated, and individualistic in an unoriginal way, to me, encompass the whole cultural moment that we're living in.
One of my favorite types of resources from the Colson Center is the What Would You Say videos. Speaking of, they're great. They're great for a short attention span too, because they're pretty short and you get a lot of meat in a little bit of time.
Intentional.
Yes. Yeah, that's good. You guys are
where they are.
Yeah, you're picking up on what's going on. That's good. So one of the videos on What Would You Say is titled Most People Don't Agree with Trans Ideology. And it cites some research that suggests a gap between what people believe and what they're actually willing to say. I think this is really fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about that study and why it matters to us as Christians, especially Christians navigating the modern secular workplace that we find ourselves in?
Sure. So we did a video on this. One of the things that you'll intuit as you realize how digitally influenced we are, influenced by those digital liturgies, right, that Samuel James writes about, is that people will adopt opinions that they think are correct or fashionable, or will get them the right attention, or will get them, you know, treated the right way. There's a pressure to say something that's in the vein of the fashionable opinion. And what this creates is a disconnect between what people actually think deep down, if you were to confront them in private, and what they say or don't say in public, because not saying something about it is a way to communicate your sort of agreement or acquiescence to the whole thing in many cases. So if you just go along with the, say, transgender ideology, right, which is what we're talking about here, then you're going to be able to get by in a lot of cases, and then get past it. So you won't have to think about it that much. I sort of had this intuition before the survey came out, but when Summit commissioned McLaughlin Associates to do this survey, I think it was of 1,000 likely voters, you know, scientifically selected to be representative of the population. And they found that, I mean, this was really just incredible. 64% of Americans who do have an opinion about this issue don't believe that transgenderism is a healthy human condition. So what that means is that you take the slice off the people who just are indifferent on the question. They don't care. The ones who have an opinion, the vast majority are of an unfavorable opinion about transgenderism. And I think you can even see this, Miranda, in the way that we might say card carrying members of the social justice and sexual identity left talk about these things. So there's a kind of below the surface, between the lines, a kind of condescension you can read where it's like, oh, yes, this transgender athlete who's actually a biological male, isn't it heroic and wonderful that she, listen to my, approving language, my inclusive language, she has won this this swimming contest against all these girls, like Lisa Thomas, or I'm trying to remember Leah Thomas. Yes, the adopted name of this transgender athlete. This is one example, right? Yeah. And everyone kind of genuflex before that. But if you really were to corner people and ask them in private, okay, do you think that's a woman? I just have this strong doubt that many people would go to the mat on that question. I think they know what's true, and they have a private opinion that, look, this is the price we pay. I think Douglas Murray talks about this in Madness of Crowds. This is the price we pay for living in a free and pluralistic society, right? This is what a progressive thinks, that yes, it's true, this person is kind of delusional and I don't really buy into the whole ideology, but in order to be fair and equitable and live in a free society that accords with the vision that I want as I try to live out my truth and my identity, we have to sacrifice some things. And if women's athletics is one of the things we sacrifice, that's fine. I think that's what's going on beneath the surface. That's just my theory. Now, separate that from the data. We don't know the reasoning behind that 64% of people. Yeah. But it tells me that there's pressure and people are conforming to the pressure. And it's not very sincerely, which you would expect given the stats on how quickly public opinion changed on this question. Just a few years ago, the public was essentially scoffed at the idea that a man could become a woman or vice versa. Now the public is nominally supportive of it, or at least they tolerate those policies and elect people who tolerate those policies and stances. But do they really think that? I think there's an opening there.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely see a lot of that go along to get along. And there's that social pressure, but also in the workplace, I think people struggle with, are they going to have not only social pressure, but actual repercussions in the workplace if they maybe work for a very progressive organization? And that's where we look at, okay, what's the point where really difficult decisions need to be made with where you're employed. But I know people find themselves in situations where they have a clash of worldviews and ideologies with their employer or their manager or their team. And I often hear and see from folks a lot of that.
I'll add this. I've got a piece coming out in the Gospel Coalition in a couple of days. And it's an answer to a question they received about this is from an epidemiologist, right? So a professional medical scientist who studies diseases and their effects on populations. And this person said, I have up until now been referring to pregnant women as pregnant women, but I see coming down the pike a pressure to begin referring to pregnant people specifically as an accommodation to transgender ideology and individuals. What should I do? Is it biblical to sort of make that accommodation? And so I answered there, but you saw exactly that. There's this sense, and you have to read the article to figure out or to see what my sense was. But there is this sense that someone's asking, why should I have to sacrifice my career and all the good that I do? Right, an epidemiologist has potential to save a lot of lives. Why should I sacrifice my good work on the altar of this stupid political scuffle that my organization has forced me into? Why can't I just sort of say what needs to be said and move on and help people? And that's a very, very important and good question. And I feel deeply the sense of like desperation and frustration that people may have. But that exactly right there is one of the pressure points you just referred to socially, where it's not just people will think badly about me. It's I might get fired. Uh-huh. I have another friend, very different profession, who worked at Disney World for a long time. We're here in Florida, right? There's a lot of Disney employees around. And he's loved this job, but he sees it in the very near future, people are going to demand that employees start putting their pronouns on their name tags. And he understands what that means. So he's kind of trying to transition away from relying on Disney for his family's income because he sees it coming and he doesn't want to have to deal with that pressure point.
Yeah. We're definitely facing new challenges that we didn't have to in the past. And so I think people, especially in certain industries, are just facing questions and pressure that they didn't even 5 years ago, let alone 10, 15, 20. I want to point to a recent Breakpoint focused on the rise and fall of evangelical America. And I appreciated the quote of, perhaps given how quickly the evangelical bubble burst, part of the problem was that it was filled with shallow belief. Tell us, Shane, what's happening in there and what the data says about the state of the church in America.
Sure. So in this Breakpoint and then a subsequent one we did just a couple of days ago, we drew heavily on a new book called The Great Dechurching. And Ryan Burge is the statistician who's behind a lot of that data. And there are a couple of other authors who contributed, but we were drawing from his research. And one of the things you notice very quickly, if you look at the self-identification as evangelical in the past several decades, is that there was this huge surge of evangelical identity that happened in the 1980s, late 1980s, early 1990s. And this is, I mean, you can probably remember this time. I remember this time as this was like my childhood, right? But this was the time when all the Christian music was getting big. All these Christian conferences were happening, huge movements filling football stadiums
BC
and stuff.
Tokyo, I mean, WWJD bracelets.
Absolutely. Yeah. Toby Mac hadn't even gone solo yet.
Yeah.
All of this stuff was happening, and it was, if not quite mainstream, then a very, very influential subculture. And this was the evangelical bubble, as they call it. Now, what has happened since the beginning of the new century in 2000 is that bubble has burst. Evangelical membership or evangelical identification has essentially gone back to what it was before the 80s. So that many people have defected or at least stopped identifying themselves as evangelicals, which essentially erases the 90s. It's as if they never happened. And we started right back where we were in the 80s, which was a time of, you know, a very different religious landscape in many ways. So that's one thing that happened. And the theory that we offer for that on Breakpoint and that John Stone Street offered was that shallow faith was to blame, that the way the evangelical movement won people over was essentially the kind of thing that Jesus is alluding to in the parable of the sower, where he says that some seed fell on rocky soil, right? And it sprang up quickly, but then when the sun rose, it withered because it didn't have roots. And Christians throughout the centuries have interpreted that to mean something like they weren't deeply rooted in their belief. It was a shallow belief. It was superficial. And I can't think of anything to better describe the kind of faith that's rooted in, I guess, only in music and style and the attraction that a certain kind of church offers, and not in deep engagement with what the Christian faith means for all of life and throughout all of history. That's shallow belief. And of course, it's going to wither when the sun comes up. The sun's like that social pressure to stop being a Christian or stop being part of this subculture. It's negative now. And that has an effect. And then the second thing was that church membership as a whole is way down, like 20 points since the year 2000. And this is significant because the mainlines the Protestant mainline churches were dying in the latter half of the 20th century. That's when most of their decline happened. They've been declining since the year 2000 still, but over the last 23 years, it's a slower decline. I think they kind of hit a floor and there weren't that many more people to lose. And so they just sort of bottomed out a bit. So most of that decline, we can safely say, is happening in more conservative areas of Christianity. And the numbers from the Southern Baptist Convention, which last year said that they lost 500,000 members in a single year. That's the largest evangelical denomination in the country. It shows that there really is a great dechurching, and it's happening in conservative circles now, not just in the, you know, liberal Methodist rainbow flag church down the street.
Mm-hmm. I'm sitting here thinking, because you and I, we both have kids. Our kids are around the same age. I feel like our generation of Christian parents, we feel the weight of needing to help our kids be equipped with more than just a shallow belief.
Yeah, this is the tried by fire thesis, mm-hmm. you know, and there were voices saying this back just about 10 years ago, that there's this great dechurching is coming. The culture is turning against Christianity. It's becoming more negative. And so this is going to force the folks who are really insincere, shallow Christians to fall away, and the real ones are going to be left behind. And I think that's true on a couple of levels, because, well, it's just, I mean, it's obvious, right? This is a very biblical pattern that you see happening. Pressure, whether political or social, or even pressure of violence, you know, threats of violence that happen in other countries predominantly, will tend to have a sorting effect. If it's not convenient to be a Christian, then the people who don't really care that much will stop being Christians. Yeah. Now, where I jump off of that sort of bandwagon is where there have been a couple of prominent voices who've talked along these lines and acted like this is a good thing. Like, it's good that cultural Christianity is over, because now we can get down to the business of being the real church. And I don't think that's true. I think that cultural Christianity is actually a very good thing for a lot of reasons. There's one big drawback to it, and that's that it supports nominalism, right? A nominal faith, that I'm just a Christian in name only. But there are many benefits. The first is that it makes it easier to become a Christian, right? You're going to hear the gospel more easily, and those assumptions will be easier to take on. But there are benefits that accrue even outside of the true believers, if you will. So mm-hmm. living in a Christian society, in a predominantly Christian culture, is very, very good for the non-Christians. They have a more humane, a more just, a more compassionate, a more charitable, a more family-centric, a more connected society. And all of these things are statistically verifiable, right? It's people who regularly attend church are happier, healthier, live longer lives, have better relationships. I mean, it's a really powerful correlation statistically. And so when you lose that, you lose part of the glue that holds society together. And I think that's really something that we should mourn, even as we recognize that there is a kind of purgative effect to Christianity becoming unpopular. Like, you're not just a Jesus freak anymore. You're a bigot. You're a homophobe. Mm-hmm. You're a misogynist. Yeah. You're whatever, for believing in basic Christian truths. And that will have a purifying effect. But in the end, I think there are better ways to purify the church than losing the whole culture. Right. That's a very negative development.
Should not be the goal. Yeah.
Right.
What would you say to the person listening in who just feels like their faith is really shallow right now? Where are some places you would have them start in strengthening their faith so that they can thrive as a Christian in the culture as we see it today?
Yeah. So I'm just going to be the shameless self-promoter and say that the thing that I invest the most time in every day, that I would recommend along these lines, is the Upstream podcast with the Colson Center. Mm-hmm. So our tagline is that we make your worldview bigger and older by taking hard questions to the headsprings of Christian wisdom. Mm-hmm. And what we mean by bigger and older is that we want to expand the scope of your Christian thinking beyond the simple Sunday morning and sexuality issues, which are kind of where everything gets focused, right? We want you to think about life together with your family, in your neighborhood, in your community, at your job, the hobbies that you take up, what you experience when you walk outside into the natural world, what you experience when you hear a piece of music, what it means to spend time in community with people and share a meal, what it means to open a good book and involve yourself in a story, all of these areas of life, what it means to be a scientist and pursue the truth empirically about the world. All those things are encompassed within this grand, beautiful picture of Christian calling, of vocation. And Upstream is about making your worldview big enough to encompass all those and to say, truly, with all your heart, I can do this to the glory of God. And I know what it means to do that. And then older means we just want to talk about ideas and thinkers that go back before the last couple of decades. I mean, we're very stuck in our modern world in this problem that C.S. Lewis highlights, where he talks about how people only read these recent books. And what happens when you read only new books is that you lock yourself into all of the errors of your time, and all the blind spots of your time are encoded into your thinking. So you can't even tell they're there. You don't even know what you don't know, right? He said, read old books, go back and look at the thinking of other ages and grapple with their assumptions and their worldview and their just picture of reality, not because they are right about everything, but because they're very unlikely to be wrong about the same things in the same way. So he said, your blind spots will be called out by those old authors, and you'll be able to probably see some of their blind spots, and together in conversation. It's a very humble way to look at it. It's very great, realistic. In conversation, you'll be able to work out a much clearer picture of a timeless picture of reality. So that's what we try to do in Upstream. And that's what I would say, if you just go and listen to some of these podcasts and see what it does for you, because I've been just so pleased with the conversations we've had, and they've enriched me tremendously. So, but the macro answer to your question, beyond listen to my podcast, right, is to realize how big and old and true Christianity is. There's this question. You may remember this curriculum that came out years ago, 2007, hosted by Del Tackett from Focus on the Family. It's called The Truth Project. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a sequel right now. John Stone Street's going to be in it. But he opens that project with this question: do you believe that what you believe is really real? And it kind of hits you between the eyes, because you realize, oh, I don't know. Am I play acting sometimes? Am I just pretending this is real because it works for me socially? But if I was confronted by ISIS, right, and I was one of those 21 Coptic martyrs in the orange jumpsuits on that beach, and they said renounce Christ right now, or we'll kill you, we'll cut your head off on camera, would you go through with that? Would you say, no, I believe in Christ so fully that I am willing to die right now for him? That's a very important question for Christians to ask ourselves. And may God never allow us to be there. Persecution is terrible. But also, the answer to that question is going to have impacts in this time, in this place, in this culture. So do you see it as really real and true? And do you see it as good? Because a lot of people look at Christianity as this big no to all what our culture says is the good life. And I mean, that's true, but our culture is wrong. That's not the good life. The good life is found in the gifts that God gives in his creation, and chiefly through redemption in Jesus Christ. And it will make you happy forever. That's literally the truth of this faith. So just start thinking along those lines and asking those questions. You'll be surprised what the riches you unearth.
I just started participating in the fellows program here in St. Louis, and have really enjoyed reading the books and digging into all of that. So just highly recommend all of the resources that y'all put out. But the Colson Center, of course, is about equipping Christians to engage with culture. And some people might not see the value in that, or maybe haven't thought about the value in that. So why is it important for Christians to not only live the Christian life, in their homes and with their families, but to actually fully and intentionally engage with culture as a whole?
So I think the first answer is that we're here. This is our place. This is our kids' place. This is where God has put us. And it's not a mistake that he's put us here. We actually belong here. In the councils of God before time began, and here I'm going to wax Calvinistic here for a second, but in God's mysterious wisdom, before he spoke the world into existence, he looked at what he was intending to do, and he said, I'm going to put Shane and Miranda in the 21st century in America, and that's going to be their place. And it's not that we were supposed to be somewhere else. We weren't supposed to be in the first century. We were supposed to be here, and he has a plan for why we're here, where he's going to use us, work us together in our lives for the glory of Christ. So that's encouraging. It reminds me of what Gandalf, tells Frodo, and it's in a different place in the book than it is in the movie, but he says, you know, Frodo says, I wish none of this had ever happened. I wish that the ring had never come to me. He just wants to wish it away. And Gandalf's like, guess what, kids? So does everyone who lives in a time like this. But that's not your choice. That's not for you to decide. All you have to decide is what to do with the time that's given you. So here we are. We have to decide what to do with the time that's given us. And he actually says that, what does he say? That the Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. There are powers at work in the world besides the will of evil. That is an encouraging thought. And we should go into our cultural approach that way, because guess what? We don't have orcs running around. We're in a place here where we belong. The second thing is that, that our neighbors and our kids, of course, but our neighbors also matter. We're not just here to serve us and our bloodline. We're here to serve those people around us. And the whole purpose of the law of God, and Jesus sums it up perfectly. You know, he says that to fulfill the law is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then love your neighbor as yourself. And everything hangs on these commandments. So it's the vertical and the horizontal. Like, we love God, and then by loving others, we fulfill that first commandment again. And that's the horizontal, to love our neighbors. So loving, what could be more important in loving our neighbors than wanting them to know the truth and live out that truth and be saved from their sins and be renewed and resurrected and forever in God's presence? That is the highest possible good. So we should will that for them. And that's a reason for living here, because we're commanded to love them. And then I would also say it's important as Christians to think along these lines, that our neighbors, our secular neighbors, our coworkers, the people that we, you know, are beside us when we ride the subway or the train or the bus, or drive on the interstate, they're not as distant from Christianity as you think they are. And there have been a lot of good books that have made this point, but we don't live in a truly pagan or post-Christian society. That may sound strange to people, but I think when you look into it, when you read a book like Tom Holland's Dominion or Glenn Scrivener's The Air We Breathe, you begin to see that our ostensibly secular neighbors actually have a lot of deeply Christian assumptions at work in their worldview, and they think of themselves as good and virtuous and altruistic people for the most part. Right. And there's a reason for that, because they think those things matter, and they think that women's rights matter, and they think that gay rights matter. And that is it's twisted, but that's a form of a Christian idea that people in a true pagan context, the Vikings, the Romans, whatever, the ancient Chinese, would have laughed at. So there are threads to grab onto that are, once you learn to see them, you realize, okay, these people are actually thinking along lines that are not self-evident at all. They're borrowing or stealing, you might say, from the Christian heritage. And they don't have a right to those beliefs. So you should point that out. Say, I'm glad you believe in human rights, my secular friend, my secular coworker. But why do you believe that? What is the basis for believing that? Does it make sense in your set of assumptions about the world? Says who? Like, why should I care about the well-being of the poor or the weak or the marginalized or the oppressed or the enslaved or the handicapped or whatever? Because if we're just material creatures, that doesn't make any sense. It does make sense if we're made in the image of a God who loves us. So yeah, those are two things I'd keep in mind.
Yeah. So much I want to go back and ask about that you were just talking about. I love that that reminder you provided, that we are in this time and place intentionally, that God put us here. And I know we can sometimes wish that we were born in a slightly different time. You know, we can look back and kind of almost glamorize that. Like, oh, things were so much better 20, 30 years ago. I think we tend to do that in Christian circles right now, with everything that's happening. We can get caught up in the issues of today, to your point, and forget the bigger picture. So I would just love to hear, as we've got a little bit of time left, what else would you like to remind the Christians who are listening in, who are maybe just feeling very defeated right now, very hopeless about what they're seeing, maybe what they're experiencing in the workplace? What are some additional things you'd like to remind them of?
So with the organization in particular, if you're facing those types of moral demands, that are coming down. It's, and they are moralistic demands. Mm-hmm. They require a certain set of behaviors that have nothing to do with the productivity or success of the work environment. It's not like something that's mission critical. If you say you work in manufacturing, okay, and you're required to burn incense to this set of woke ideological principles, if you want to put it that way, or take an example of transgender ideology, you're supposed to acknowledge this in some way, not because there are actually people in the cubicle next to you or on the assembly line next to you who are demanding these things for their psychological well-being, but just because it's a thing you have to do in order to exist in the corporate environment. That's a weird position to be in, because it doesn't seem like there's an obvious and pressing demand that has pushed you to that point. And it's very difficult. This is where it becomes hard to answer the question, because it's difficult to confront a corporation, right? It's difficult to challenge a policy. The human resources is a very unforgiving opponent. You can't really single-handedly go up against them in an effective way. There has to be a lot of teamwork and collaboration and coordination in order to change that sort of situation. And I don't have any specific answers on that. But when it comes to individuals, when it comes to coworkers, things are different, because you can have conversations with those people. You can talk to a real person and touch a heart or a mind. You can look into someone's eyes. You can ask them questions about what matters to them and why they care deeply about these things, and then what they believe to be really real and true about the world. So with that, I would say be encouraged that these people are not, I say these people, meaning those who bought into an ideology, the ideology we're talking about, they're probably not happy. And this is statistically a very safe statement to make. Mental health issues are at an all-time high. It's never been this bad. Suicidal ideation and attempts are at or near an all-time high. They were obviously worse during the pandemic, and it just sort of hasn't recovered at this point. But it was moving in that direction already well before COVID. And what that means is that people are struggling existentially with how the world works and what it means and why they should live and whether their lives are important at all and whether anybody loves them and what love even means. And those are questions that torture you, especially if you've come from a background where your family's broken and you don't have any sure and primal answers to those things. There's another Mary Eberstadt book that's really good on this. It's called Primal Screams. And she makes the case that she's one for provocative theses, and this one's the most provocative, that the whole sexual identity and gender identity movement emerged out of the generation of divorce, where families were broken and kids began to ask these deep and heart-wrenching questions about who they really are. And they weren't getting an answer from the structure of marriage and family like they used to. And so they began looking for answers elsewhere. And the sexual and gender identity movement is what really filled the gap. But it's not a satisfying answer. And I think we could delve into the stats about, you know, how transition doesn't help you, about how suicidal ideation continues. And that's just one example, right? But I would say be encouraged that your coworkers are probably not satisfied with what they've been given. And they probably have much deeper questions. And if those stats that we cited earlier from Summit and McLaughlin are any clue, a lot of them are kind of on the fence. They're not really convinced about this whole thing, but they're going along to get along. And that's a really good posture from which to approach them. The next thing is, and this is far more important, Jesus is on his throne and he will win. He's already won. And he is winning now, and he loves his bride and will preserve her. He won't allow her to perish or be destroyed or be corrupted finally and fully by the forces of this world. He's ruling. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him, and he's put us in this place, and he has a plan. Nothing surprised him. The whole woke ideological wave has not surprised him at all. He's on top of it. So be encouraged that he's in control. And then along those lines, this is my Father's world. That's my favorite hymn, you know, Malt Be Babcock's This Is My Father's World. And the last verse of that is just so powerful. I can hardly ever sing it without, you know, my eyes welling up with tears, because he says, this is my father's world. Let me never forget that though the wrong seems off so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my father's world. The battle is not done. Jesus, who died, will be satisfied, and earth and heaven be one. And that is, I mean, that is our hope. This place belongs to him, and these people belong to him, and he sets the rules. He made it. He made the human machine, as Lewis says this. He made the human machine as an engineer makes a car, right? And he knows the specifications better than anyone else. And he determined the type of fuel that we are to run on. And all that we see around us right now, Miranda, is people trying to run the human machine, their bodies, their souls, their existence on the wrong fuel. And they're going to break down. They're going to be hurt and destroyed. And if they don't repent, and if their hearts aren't changed, they're going to be damned for it. They're going to destroy themselves forever by this. They're not made for this. They were made for something better. And so I think we can take an encouragement from the fact that the world is on our side, in a sense, in the most important sense. God made it. And it won't work for those around us doing it the wrong way. And when it doesn't work, and when they're broken by that, that should be a very opportune moment for us to move in as Christians and say, hey, I have something better. In fact, I've got the true story of the world, and I know the one who made you, and I know what will ultimately fulfill you and make you thrive and give you joy. And even though you suffer in this world, you will count it joy, because you know him and you know what he's done in Christ. And this is Augustine's great, you know, in one of the greatest insights that he left us with as Christians, is that our hearts are eternally restless. We are born restless, and they will remain eternally restless until we find our rest in God, because he's the one for whom our hearts were made. So take hope, Christian, because even in the wokest, craziest, most off the, you know, unhinged workplace that you can possibly imagine, there are people there who are filling their gas tanks with the wrong juice, and it's hurting them in ways that they can't even probably comprehend fully. And you have to be there to be the person who, provided you are able to prudently be there, right? Don't compromise your principles. But if you can be there among them and offer some hope and offer the truth with your life and with your words and with your testimony, then that is work well done. That is something that God will reward in the end, I believe, with well done, good and faithful servant. And how much more reward will it be to see people who heard that and acted on it, and the Lord acted in their hearts through your testimony? That's got to be the most moving experience that you could possibly have as a Christian, to see that happen.
Yeah, such good and kingdom-minded input there for interacting as an individual and with individuals at work. If you're listening in and you are struggling organizationally or with the HR department Shane was talking about, we do have ADF, Bob Pruitt from ADF coming back on to join us a second time to answer some new questions about navigating some of those big hairy scenarios in the workplace. So we'll look forward to that in a few weeks. Shane, this has just been awesome. Love the conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the Christian professionals who are listening in today?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to point them to the overall resources of the Colson Center. We have been just like, I mean, we have been retooling in a way that is so exciting. The Colson Fellows program is better than it's ever been, bigger than it's ever been. Upstream has some really exciting stuff happening. Strong Women, the other podcast we do, Sarah Stenstreet hosts that, is just, I mean, they're firing on all cylinders, and they've got some fantastic guests. And then Breakpoint has just been able to tackle some really important issues lately, I think, in nuanced and helpful ways. And you know, John is great at leading us in that direction, and helping us to just get our fingers as writers and as an editorial team at Breakpoint on the pulse of what's really going on. And in that respect, I think he's following in the, you know, the best of the Colson tradition. I had the joy of working with Chuck Colson for a couple of years before he passed away, and I'll never forget that. But his example is being followed, and I think that we've got we got a lot of cool stuff going on at Breakpoint. So check us out, breakpoint.org, colsoncenter.org, colsoncenter.org/upstream is my place.
Yeah, very cool. Well, we will link to all the goods in the show notes. Shane, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been great to have you.
Thank you, Miranda.